against the aggressive policies of Zionist enemy, also Hezbollah in Lebanon. We witness the aggressions on daily basis that are targeting Syria, also the Judaization of Manama in Bahrain. All of these movements that are taking place by the Zionist enemy will lead eventually, yes, to another intifada, and perhaps it's time that we will witness the collapse of this temporary Zionist occupation in our West Asia region.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barra, joining us from Madison, and Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 97 to 99 of chapter Nisan from the Holy Quran, recited by Hashim Rouhani.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Innal ladhina tawaffahum al malaa'ikatu ظالمي أنفسهم قالوا فيما كنتم قالوا كنا مستضعفين في الأرض قالوا ألم تكن أرض الله واسعة فتهاجروا فيها فأولئك مأواهم جهنم وساءت مصيرا إلا فَأُولَئِكَ عَسَى اللَّهُ أَن يَعْفُوَ عَنْهُمْ وَكَانَ اللَّهُ عَفُوًّا غَفُورًا صَدَقَ اللَّهُ الْعَلِيُّ الْعَظِيمُ.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Surely as for those whom angels cause to die while they are unjust to their souls, they shall say, "In what state were you?" They shall say, "We were weak in the earth." They shall say, "Was not Allah's earth spacious so that you should have migrated therein?" So these it is whose abode is hell, and it is an evil resort. Except the weak from among the men and the children, who have not in their power the means, nor can they find a way to escape. So these, it may be, Allah will pardon them, and Allah is pardoning, forgiving. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Urges the U.S. and Japan to abandon their Cold War mentality and ideological bias against China. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte says she will not step down, defying demands by protesters over the past weeks. Also ahead, Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, will be investigated in a probe into the January 8th riots in the capital, Brasilia. Hello everyone, a very warm welcome to World News. Now, Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida is in the U.S. as part of his tour to the Group of Seven developed countries to boost ties. Now, Kishida has called on the U.S. and Europe to act in unison with Japan against China as a key challenge. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed the depth in China phobia of the West, the U.S. in particular, as well as some Asia-Pacific countries. Here it is.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Japan's Prime Minister has called on the U.S. and Europe to act in unison with Tokyo against China as a key challenge. Fumio Kishida says his country will never allow any attempt by China to unilaterally change the existing international order by force. Kishida says Tokyo remains concerned about China's military activities in the East China Sea, and it will reinforce its defense capabilities. Kishida, who earlier met with the country's President Joe Biden during the meeting, said that Washington remains committed to the alliance to Tokyo. And also, the U.S. president said that Japan's recent announcement of its largest military overhaul since World War II made Washington happy. Earlier, Beijing slammed the U.S. and Japan for what they call a war mentality and groundless attacks on China. Now, to discuss that further, we are joined by William Jones, Executive Intelligence Review from Leesburg, and Matthew Arrett, a political analyst who's joining us live from Montreal. Let's begin with Mr. William Jones. How serious do you see the military buildup in the South China Sea, and do you predict any escalations?
Their primary role in the Asia Pacific, which they feel that they lost through the loss of in World War II. And so they're piggybacking on the U.S. need for these major alliances in order to put a front against China in order to boost their own role in the region. That is, although they're in very much close contact with the United States, the Japanese have their own agenda for the Asia Pacific. And it reflects some of what we've seen historically in the last century as well. Well, it's a very dangerous development. The Chinese are taking it very seriously, probably more seriously than the statement by Wang Wenbin today.
Okay, so Mr. Arrett, you just heard Mr. Jones. How serious do you see the situation? And do you believe that we should be expecting any kind of escalation anytime soon?
Well, I was only able to somewhat hear some of Mr. Jones's contributions, so if I repeat anything, I apologize, but it is indeed extremely serious and dire. The fact is that it's not simply about Japan per se, but rather the entire encirclement, the containment of China, of which there are 100,000 U.S. troops in the Pacific in China's backyard, South Korea, Japan, massively conducting saber-rattling, and this has been going on since the Asia Pivot was really launched by Obama, which has been taken up in full force. And so, as Mr. Jones has said, there is a targeting of both Russia as well as China, and those who are pushing this policy, and especially getting Japan to let go of Article 9 in its pacifist constitution in order to allow for Japan to carry out an offensive strike in the context of its allies being threatened, which is very, very ambiguous.
How do you see the future, considering the reactions that we've seen from the U.S. and Japan?
China is a major player, is one of the biggest trading partner in the world today. The world economy is more dependent upon what China does, what decisions they make, than really what the U.S. decides. And most of the world realizes that. China has also built up a great deal of goodwill in the world generally, particularly in the developing countries, who are more or less opposed or very skeptical of the U.S. moves to reassert their so-called hegemony. So the U.S. has a tremendous amount of military power, especially through this grouping of alliances, or what you would call the global NATO. But it's not clear how far that's going to go. They're having trouble in Europe now because of the conflict in Ukraine, which the United States is continuing to push in order to whittle down Russia somewhat. And in the Asia Pacific region, most countries are concerned about getting out of this COVID pandemic and getting back to economic activity. In that respect, China and its opening up and its reduction of the COVID restrictions that we've seen in the last couple of days has created a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. So you have good signs coming out of there, and I think a lot of goodwill for China and opposition to this attempt to create a new Cold War on the part of most of the world.
So, Mr. Arrett, as Mr. Jones mentioned, hegemony is the name of the game the U.S. is playing. On the other hand, China is asking the U.S. and Japan to let go of that Cold War mentality. Do you believe that the U.S. will ever give up that will to be in a unipolar world where it can say that the U.S. is calling the shots?
Well, I think if the United States is to survive the coming storm, which in many cases it's brought on to itself, it will be because it rediscovers its lost or its forgotten heritage, which once put the emphasis upon win-win cooperation and looking for the benefit of our neighbors in the context of mutual economic development, which we saw with the foreign policy outlook of people like John F. Kennedy, like Franklin Roosevelt, like many of the great Americans who tend to get assassinated while in office. However, I mean, China today has really taken up that torch of a win-win philosophy, and I think that's one of the best points of salvation for the nations of the world in this time of crisis. So certainly China has always emphasized the importance of cooperation around things like the regional comprehensive economic partnership, which amongst those nations of the Pacific, this is one of the biggest and most important free trade agreement zones in the world, but tied to China's emphasis on building real infrastructure, building and increasing the productive powers of labor of society. And amongst the ASEAN countries, China's trade has increased in 2022 by a factor of 15%.
Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views on this edition of the News Review.
And welcome back. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte defies calls for the resignation after weeks of protests, citing her commitment to the country.
Some voices coming from the violent and radical groups demand my resignation, bringing people to chaos, disorder, and destruction. I tell them in a responsible way, I will not step down. My commitment is with Peru, and not with this tiny group that is hurting our homeland.
Boluarte also rejected calls to dissolve Congress, citing lack of legal conditions, but she apologized for dozens of deaths caused by during the protests. The president is demanding an inquiry into the type of guns used to shoot at protesters. She said the guns are different from those used by police. Peru's attorney general has already launched an investigation into the deadly clashes and protests. Those rallies broke out in December following the ouster and arrest of former President Pedro Castillo. Now he's in pretrial detention now for attempting to dissolve Congress to avoid impeachment. The protesters want his immediate release. And Brazil's far-right ex-president Jair Bolsonaro will be investigated over the January 8th attacks on government buildings in the capital, Brasilia. The investigation will focus on the origins of the insurrection. A Supreme Court judge says Bolsonaro will be probed in response to a request by the Office of the Prosecutor General. Office has cited a video that Bolsonaro posted 2 days after the riots in Brasilia. In that video, Bolsonaro had questioned the regularity of the 2022 elections won by his leftist rival, Ignacio Lula da Silva. The prosecutor general says that by publishing that video, Bolsonaro would have publicly incited the commission of a crime. Says even though the video came after the riots, it may serve as a connection justifying the probe into acts by Bolsonaro before and after the attacks. The former president has denied any involvement. The real estate company of former U.S. President Donald Trump has been fined $1.6 million for tax crimes. A New York judge imposed a sentence after jurors found the Trump Organization guilty of committing fraud and falsifying business records for 15 years. This is the first ever criminal conviction of one of Trump's companies, and it comes after his tax returns were released earlier this month. Still, an attorney and former federal prosecutor says the fine shouldn't really make a meaningful difference for the company, considering its revenues. The Trump Organization has denied any wrongdoing and says it will appeal the conviction. Trump himself has called it part of the Democrats' witch hunt. He also faces several other legal challenges as he sets out to run for president in 2024. So will the verdict against Trump's company affect his presidential bid? Our Washington correspondent Colin Campbell explains.
This is really a small amount that was where the Trump entities are forced to pay $1.6 million from a billion-dollar real estate investor out of several Trump entities. We have to remember, this is more than three Trump entities. This is several of his entities. And we have to remember that this is tax evasion. So if you have several entities that make millions of dollars a year, to pay $1.6 million or be forced to pay that, even though it is the maximum penalty, is pretty small. And this is 17 counts of tax evasion, of fraud. So there are a lot of counts there. Now, if you're wondering if this would affect his run for 2024, it's highly unlikely that this will heavily impact his run. This is because we have to remember that these are his entities that were convicted of wrongdoing, not the president himself. Even though one of his closest assistants, Alan Weisselberg, was sentenced earlier, just a couple days ago, and ordered to pay $2 million on top of a five-month fine. Weisselberg worked with prosecutors to implicate Trump's entities
Trump, in return, denied that Weisselberg worked with him and said that Weisselberg worked alone and that he went rogue, basically, and did all of this illegality on his own, which many people find hard to believe.
And now U.S. police brutality takes another victim. Unarmed black man Keenan Anderson dies just hours after he was repeatedly tasered and restrained by Los Angeles police following a traffic accident. Anderson, 31-year-old teacher and father, was also a cousin of Black Lives Matter co-founder Patrice Cullors. Anderson went into cardiac arrest several hours after this encounter on January 3rd. Los Angeles police released body cam footage of this incident after public outcry. They say that Anderson tried to run away after the crash. The cause of his death has not been officially determined. Black Lives Matter movement says Anderson was killed by police, though. His death brings the 3 number of people killed in encounters with Los Angeles police in less than a week. Police brutality against people of color is a source of public outcry in the U.S. Earlier, we spoke to co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, Margaret Kimberly, on police killings in America and the cause of so much police violence.
Well, this past year, in 2022, there were more than 1,100 police killings, an average of 3 people every day. On average, one of those persons will be black and 2 are not. But we have this country where it is acceptable. There's no point in sugarcoating it, where the police have this power over our lives, and it's more than 1,000 people a year. We have a culture that's violent, that's militarized, and there's no way for that not to trickle down to policing and the way that it's carried out, where the police, they police, as a verb, black people all the time, no matter they can have an accident. There's some people say he actually asked for police assistance after a car accident. It wouldn't be the first black person to die after calling for help, but the nature of policing is such that incidents like this, deaths like this, are inevitable.
Now, Sweden takes over the rotating presidency of the European Union with a vow to oppose Russia and support Ukraine. Critics believe the EU's foreign policy towards Moscow is set to backfire even further this year. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
Stockholm's government has just taken over the rotating presidency of the European Union. It holds the position for the next 6 months and faces many challenges. Amid the conflict in Ukraine, the powers that be in Moscow have been singled out.
This is the peaceful order that the Putin regime now seeks to destroy. But we will defend it here and in Ukraine and everywhere.
Many analysts say the EU has shot itself in the foot by provoking and isolating Russia at Washington's behest. Accommodation, food and energy prices remain extremely high in the EU. The European Parliament has just published results of a survey which shows cost of living is the number one concern for citizens.
Of course, I'm looking to go in and buy my own house at the moment. That's a bit difficult to decide. Is it a good time? Is it not a good time?
Is the reliance on food banks is shocking. Even for people in full-time employment, like police officers, teachers.
For instance, Brussels, I think, is the city of trainees, of interns who try to start your career. And, for instance, you can have an internship that is not paid, and what you do?
The EU has sent €50 billion to Ukraine during the past 10 months, mostly to provide deadly weapons. Critics say the West wants to feed the arms industry and then make huge profits for Western companies when it finally comes to picking up the pieces.
We are preparing for Ukraine's reconstruction. The international donors platform that we set up with our G7 partners will be up and running this month.
Anti-war activists say many problems could have been averted if Moscow's security concerns had been listened to by NATO and the EU. Tourism industry representatives are asking the European Commission to intervene because in some EU countries, 1/3 of all rooms being offered by hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that's a wrap for your latest. Thanks for tuning in and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
Russian oil is being rerouted to Asia, Africa, and Latin America, while West Asian suppliers are boosting sales to the EU, Wall Street Journal has reported. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote in this regard, Western sanctions on Russian energy resources are triggering a shift in global oil and gas flows and disrupting long-standing economic ties around the world, the Wall Street Journal has reported. An EU embargo on seaborne Russian crude took effect on December 5th, along with a $60 price cap on oil exports, as part of a sixth package of Ukraine-related sanctions imposed on Moscow. A ban on EU imports of petroleum products such as diesel and kerosene originating from Russia will come into force on February 5th. The restrictions prompted Russia, once Europe's biggest supplier, to reroute its energy exports to India and China, where buyers are taking advantage of discounts that Moscow offers. Since late November, Russia has reportedly been selling its flagship Urals crude for $17 less than the cap, the WSJ reported, citing the International Energy Agency. Amrita Sen, the head of research at oil consulting company Energy Aspect, said even if prices were to rise to $100 a barrel, China and India can continue buying Russian oil if they have access to their own insurance. Russia boosted oil deliveries to China by 17% in November, from a year earlier to 7.81 million tons, the highest total since August, overtaking Saudi Arabia as the country's top supplier. Moscow's shipments to India surged to 1.4 million barrels a day in November, compared to just 36,000 barrels a day a year earlier, according to commodity data provider Kepler. Indian refiners are profiting from selling oil products made from processed Russian oil to energy-strapped Europe, enjoying an exemption allowed by the Black Sanctions Program. Russian oil products have also been redirected to markets in Africa and Latin America, according to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak. Meanwhile, the major West Asian energy exporters have shifted their focus away from traditional markets in Asia and are reaping the benefits from skyrocketing fossil fuel prices in Europe. Meanwhile, Business Daily Kommersant reported recently that Russian oil major Rosneft is looking to export natural gas directly to China via the second route of the Power of Siberia pipeline, which is being developed by Gazprom. Rosneft is reportedly seeking to export natural gas from its reserves located in the south of the Krasnoyarsk territory and in Irkutsk region, which contain 1 trillion cubic meters and 5/10 trillion cubic meters of gas, respectively. As well as being Russia's largest oil company, Rosneft is also the country's third largest natural gas producer, after Gazprom and Novatek. Rosneft's chief executive Igor Sechin submitted a letter to Russian President Vladimir Putin in December, asking to include the company as a potential supplier of gas via the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline, in addition to the project leader Gazprom, sources familiar with the contents of the document told the media. The company expects the Kremlin to take into account the volumes of independent producers to achieve a synergistic effect in the construction of the gas pipeline. According to the report, the Russian president instructed Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak to resolve the issue with Rosneft and Gazprom back in December. The Power of Siberia pipeline, which became operational at the end of 2019 after 8 years of construction, is currently being used to send gas to China under a bilateral long-term agreement between the two countries. The mega pipeline, which is expected to be completed and become fully operational by 2025, will provide China with 38 billion cubic meters of Russian natural gas annually starting in 2024. The Power of Siberia 2, the second route of the pipeline, is expected to come into operation by 2030. It will connect gas fields in the western and eastern Russia to deliver gas to China via Mongolia. We'll be right back.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Football and politics. I don't think we know Jonas Salk. The name doesn't really ring a bell. Jonas Salk is a person who developed polio vaccine for everyone free of charge. All of us are indebted to him, but we just don't know him. On the other hand, there are many people who may not know Zlatan Ibrahimovic. Or, for example, we don't know the name of the president of Gabon. Actually, most of us don't know anything about Gabon, but we know Aubameyang, the Gabonese football player. This is a rule. Football players are the most famous people. People, even in far-fetched places in the world, love football, and they follow everything about football. You only need to be in the first layer of football. Then everyone in the world will fix their eyes on you, and everyone in the world will know you. Football is the key to fame. Football is the key to popularity. Fame and popularity will bring power and wealth. This is what subconsciously draws politicians to football.
The 45-year-old is the third richest person in the UK with an estimated fortune of over £10 billion. He bought Chelsea Football Club in 2003 and has the ear of the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, who got extremely rich after the collapse of the Soviet Union and about the power struggles in modern Russia.
The name of many politicians in the world are so tightly intertwined with football that people in the world can hardly remember their political designation. For example, not many people remember Roman Abramovich, the owner of the Chelsea club, was once a member of the Russian parliament, the Duma, or was a governor of a district in Russia. Many people in the world know Silvio Berlusconi, not a powerful former Italian prime minister, but as the owner of AC Milan Club. Many people don't care the current owner of the Manchester City Club is the vice president of the Cabinet of Minister of the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, and this is not the entire story. Evo Morales, the former president of Bolivia, played football in friendly and local matches in front of thousands of his supporters and those who voted for him.
Sadi is sort of the black sheep of the Gaddafi family. He tried to enter professional football or soccer in Italy. He played one game for Perugia, but then failed a drug test.
Sadi, Gaddafi's third son, left no stone unturned so he could play in Calcio. And the legendary Fidel Castro loved to spend time with Maradona, a world-class legend of football. Many politicians are directly engaged in the game of football. The story doesn't end here. Political parties and groups love to use the popularity of great football players to achieve power. For example, Kaká Khaled, AC Milan's robust defense, was elected as the mayor of Tbilisi. Before that, George Weah, the legendary striker of Milan, became the president of Liberia. Brazil's Romário became a member of parliament in his country. Before that, Hakan Şükür, the renowned Turkish forward, was voted to become a member of parliament. In 2008, when Roman Pavlyuchenko was scoring a goal against Edwin van der Sar like this, he had been voted as a member of the Duma in Russia. Sometimes it's the football players themselves who use people to guarantee that their people's political goals will be fulfilled. For example, Dr. Socrates, with his memorable goals against Russia or Italy, he was a genius who would sometimes wear headbands with political slogans on them. He would also wear shirts with political slogans and would fight the military dictatorship in Brazil like a revolutionary. Or Lillian Thuram, who made interviews in support of immigrants and black people and those who live in shanty towns in France. He had vitriolic words for then French president.
When you're the president of the Republic of France, you can make speeches like Mr. Sarkozy did in Dakar, for example, when he explained that black people had never made a mark on history. It was a racist speech.
Or Didier Drogba, who used his popularity to help stop the civil war in the Ivory Coast. Football and politics are twins. No politician could ignore a weapon named football, and when insignificant clubs and less famous players can have remarkable political roles and influence, it's only natural that the World Cup turns into a major opportunity for political campaigns. Millions of people are glued to the games for a month. The headlines of all media are about this big event. All cameras in the world are directed towards the World Cup. It's the best opportunity to be seen, to be known, to become popular, and to gain power and influence. That's why most of the great politicians, one way or another, pretend that they're involved with the World Cup. That's why politicians try to direct the World Cup.
The 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar.
The game of the politicians for the World Cup starts from the time of selecting the host. They meet FIFA officials. They discuss with other heads of states. They deliver speeches and advertise. They spend their money, fame, and credit. Even in some cases, they might spend illegal money to be chosen as the host. Being chosen as a host means economic boosts, increase in popularity, and to a great deal, guaranteeing the political future. It's natural that people in a country are satisfied with the politicians who take the most important event to their country. But what if they're not the host?
Landon, what do we got? Hope you guys caught that. That doesn't happen very often. Okay, and what do we got here? That's good.
Well, in that case, they meet the players and the national team coach as a first stage. Almost all presidents and prime ministers take a sneak peek at the national team preparations before they go for the competitions. They take as many pictures as they can and record videos with famous players and announce their support for the representatives of their country to the world. And now, they have to show themselves in the World Cup. They enter the stadium and sit right next to each other in the VIP stands and show themselves so worried or happy so everyone knows that there is nothing more important for them than their national team. If they can't take part in person, they record a video message.
Man, I just wanted to call and say you guys did us proud.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you guys captured the hearts and imaginations of the whole country. It's unbelievable.
Well, we heard you were watching, and we know how big a supporter you are, so hopefully we made you proud. It was our honor, as it always is, to represent our country.
All right, appreciate you guys. Safe travels back.
Thanks for your call.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Sometimes they even make controversial interviews about the incidents during the World Cup. For example, after Suarez was dismissed and Uruguay was defeated by Colombia, then-President Jose Mujica took part in the ceremony to commemorate the Uruguayan football star and in an interview branded FIFA officials as a bunch of sons of who defeated his country's team on purpose. It's true, an all-out political show takes place on the sidelines of the World Cup. That's why politicians get extremely happy over their team's ascent to the World Cup. The World Cup gives them plenty of opportunities so they can promote their status or stabilize it, or at least it gives them an opportunity to show themselves to the world.
And the break is on Amiri. Osmoun's through on goal here. He can put it round ahead. It's Osmoun! Suspended save into Hamdash.
The first achievement is getting closer to the citizens. Ordinary people are crazy about football. They love their national team. Victory, pride, and their flag is more important than anything else for them. When the president of a country watches people's favorite team just like them, it can mean that he's part of the people. He has the same interests and obsessions, and he will do anything so their favorite team, namely the favorite team of his fellow citizens, will win. This public belief is a major point in the minds of voters in the next elections and in the mind of the people in other countries who consider it as a symbol of a nation. Besides all of this, participation of a country in the World Cup and its success during the games will change everything in that country. Public joy and spirit, unity among the people, and even satisfaction with the standard of living.
The first ever meeting.
Politicians love the World Cup. They use this opportunity to achieve their goals, and this is one of the reasons of the theory that the World Cup is a political phenomenon. Yes, it's one of the reasons.
It should, and Shaqiri now for Switzerland. Can he win it? Shaqiri scores! What a turnaround from Switzerland. One goal down at the break. They have now scored twice in this second half.
The other reason is politics has always imposed itself on the World Cup throughout history. The competitions have always been a symbolic scene for conflicting political forces. It's a rich political history. The 1934 World Cup was held in Italy. Mussolini, the fascist leader of Italy at the time, would go to the stadium, becoming the champion was so important for Mussolini that he did whatever it took to achieve that. He even invited the referee who would officiate the Italy-Austria match to a private party on the eve of the game. The flamboyant closing ceremony of that edition of the World Cup was held in a completely nationalistic atmosphere. The political tinge was obvious in the next World Cup as well. When the national anthem of Italy was being played, the Italian players hailed like fascists as a military unit. On the other hand, the German team was a combination of German and Austrian players, 7 German players and 4 Austrian players, because the same year, Hitler had managed to annex Austria to German territory. That year, Italy became the champion for a second time. Mussolini achieved everything he wanted from football, nationalistic passion, joy, pride, public excitement, and unity. Later on, in the 1954 World Cup, Bern was a realm of muscle flexing for Germans. Only 9 years after a war that ruined the country, the Germans showcased their indefatigable and fighting spirit. In the strangest final match in history, they defeated Hungary in a dreamlike comeback and revived their national pride that had been trampled upon. Now, the defeated Germany had something to take pride in, a symbol of the uprising of a country that had lost everything it had. In the following World Cups, football turned into a symbol of rivalry between the East and West. The Eastern Bloc countries try to flaunt the orderly structure and teamwork in their societies within their teams as well. For them, football was a battle. It was an arena to prove that their philosophical and political beliefs were correct. In the 1958 World Cup, the Soviet Union defeated Britain, and North Korea became a phenomenon in 1966 and defeated powerful Italy 1-0. Later on, in the playoff match in 1974, the Soviet Union had to play against Chile. The political officials of the Communist Party decided not to play in Chile as a protest. Pinochet, the Western-backed dictator, had just orchestrated a coup, and the Santiago Stadium had turned into the biggest political prison in the world. FIFA announced the result 3-0 in favor of Chile. As ordered by General Pinochet, the Chilean players were in the field and were attacking the Soviets' empty goal. Chile took part in the 1974 World Cup. The confrontation between the East and West reached its climax when the two swaths of the post-war Germany, namely the East and the West, played against each other. Afterwards, politicians came up with the idea of changing the results. There are strange but unconfirmed reports about match fixing in the 1978 World Cup in Argentina. General Jorge Videla, the Argentine dictator back then, and Morales Peros, the Peruvian president, they say the Argentine government forcibly disappeared some of the Peruvian dissidents exactly the way it would deal with its own dissidents. In return, Peru received 6 goals in a suspicious match and paved the path for Argentina to become champion. The dictator back then needed it to calm the public. Four years later, in the 1982 World Cup, fixing the outcome by political authorities did not need any conspiracy. When Kuwait received the 4th goal from France, a Kuwaiti official got into the field and kicked a fuss and threatened that he'd get his team off the field. The fuss yielded a result. The referee disallowed the goal, and the raging politician went back to the stands.
The World Cup is beloved across our planet because it offers a chance for people from around the world to be judged not by the place they grew up, the color of their skin, or the way they choose to worship, but by their spirit, skill, and strength.
And finally, one of the most politically charged games in the history of the World Cup, the match between Iran and the U.S.
As we cheer today's game between American and Iranian athletes, I hope it can be another step toward ending the estrangement between our nations.
Let's not forget that the World Cup is not just a sports event. It's part of a political process for politicians to gain power and popularity. Let's not forget that only with a little attention, we could see that the World Cup, with all of the issues that surround it, is a tool in the hands of different governments to push their goals forward. Let's not forget that every minor incident in the World Cup might affect the political fate of millions of people. And the exciting and attractive games of the World Cup can be more than a simple football match. For example, it might be a political battlefield for 2 countries or 2 political schools. Let's remember that political powers affect the World Cup, and the World Cup affects political powers. This time, we can view it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
In the limelight.
In the United States, federal prosecutors are reviewing classified documents found at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in Washington, an office belonging to President Joe Biden. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. A small number of government documents marked as classified were found this fall by lawyers for President Joe Biden in a locked closet in Washington, D.C., a think tank office used by Joe Biden when he was a private citizen, his lawyers confirmed on Monday, 9th of January. The Department of Justice and the National Archives and Records Administration are reviewing the circumstances surrounding the documents, according to a statement by Richard Sober, a special counsel to President Biden. Richard Sober said the documents appear to be from the Obama administration, during which Joe Biden served as vice president. The documents, Richard Sober said, were found at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement on 2nd of November 2022. That was nearly 3 months after FBI agents raided the Florida residence of former President Donald Trump and seized more than 100 classified government documents and hundreds of more records that federal prosecutors say belong to the U.S. government. Donald Trump is the focus of a criminal probe by the Department of Justice for his removal of the records from the White House in January of 2021. By law, government records must be given to the National Archives when a president or officials in their administration leave office. Richard Sober's statement was issued after CBS News first reported the discovery of the records at the Penn Biden Center. A source familiar with the situation told NBC News that Attorney General Merrick Garland asked the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, John Lausch, to review how classified materials ended up at the Penn Biden Center in Washington. That task was intentionally assigned to John Lausch, who was appointed to the prosecutor's office by Donald Trump to avoid any potential conflict of interest, the source told NBC. On Monday night, Donald Trump wrote in a post on his social media site, "When is the FBI going to raid the many homes of Joe Biden, perhaps even the White House? These documents were definitely not declassified," Trump wrote. Donald Trump has claimed without evidence that he declassified records found at his Mar-a-Lago club in Palm Beach, Florida. Even if Trump had declassified the records that had classified markings, he still could face criminal prosecution if the Department of Justice finds he likely broke the law by removing all the records from the White House and by obstructing efforts to recover them. President Biden, during an appearance on the CBS News show 60 Minutes in September, had expressed dismay at an FBI photograph that showed some of the government records found at Mar-a-Lago. "How that could possibly happen? How anyone could be that irresponsible?" Joe Biden asked. "Totally irresponsible." Richard Sober's statement about the Biden documents on Monday, 9th of January, which was provided by the White House, said, "The documents were discovered when the president's personal attorneys were packing files housed in a locked closet to prepare to vacate office space at the center." CBS News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Attorney General Merrick Garland has assigned a U.S. attorney in Chicago to review documents marked classified that were found at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement in Washington. Two sources with knowledge of the inquiry told CBS News. The roughly 10 documents are from President Biden's vice presidential office at the center, the source said. CBS News has learned the FBI is also involved in the U.S. attorney's inquiry. The material was identified by personal attorneys for President Biden on 2nd of November last year, just before the midterm elections. Richard Sober, a special counsel to the president, confirmed. The documents were discovered when President Biden's personal attorneys were packing files housed in a locked closet to prepare to vacate office space at the Penn Biden Center in Washington, D.C., Richard Sober said in a statement to CBS News. The documents were contained in a folder that was in a box with other unclassified papers, the sources confirmed. The sources revealed neither what the documents contain nor their level of classification. A source familiar with the matter told CBS News the documents did not contain nuclear secrets. Richard Sober also said that on the same day the material was discovered, on 2nd of November 2022, the White House Counsel's office notified the National Archives, which took possession of the materials the following morning. The discovery of these documents was made by the president's attorneys, Richard Sober said. The documents were not the subject of any previous request or inquiry by the National Archives. Since that discovery, the president's personal attorneys have cooperated with the archives and the Department of Justice in a process to ensure that any Obama-Biden administration records are appropriately in the possession of the National Archives.
This is IRIB English Radio.